Hit the great outdoors with the Extreme Canada Summer Podcast Series. Every week, host Paul Karchet tries a new fringe sport, like street luge, bull riding, and freediving. Go to cbc.ca/extremecanada to download the podcast. Watch unbelievable videos of Paul's adventures. And enter the weekly giveaways for Mountain Equipment Co-op gear.
From very different worlds, each with something to say about the link between art and soul. Can you tell which one was the artist, Marc Chagall, and which one the monk, Thomas Merton? Quote, "Art seems to me to be above all a state of soul. All souls are sacred, the soul of all the bipeds in every quarter of the globe." And another quote. Art is not an end in itself. It introduces the soul into a higher spiritual order, which it expresses and in some sense explains.
Art seems to me to be above all a state of soul.
It introduces the soul into a higher spiritual order.
Okay, maybe it doesn't matter who said what. Marc Chagall and Thomas Merton were expressing very similar ideas about the spiritual power of art. Just for the record, Chagall's quote was the first. Today we're exploring the intricate relationship between art and soul. We'll have a feature interview with the world-renowned wildlife artist, Robert Bateman.
I'm not totally kooky about it, but I try to get inside the skin a bit. So you have to think the red-tailed hawk. Mm. You have to think the form of that leaf.
We'll hear from a former nurse who witnessed a healing influence of music on her patients.
Completely transformed my thinking to be that music needs to be about selflessness.
And we ask a simple question. If you want to find God, should you maybe start at an art gallery? This is Tapestry. I'm Mary Hines.
Saying more about what the concept of going to an art gallery is all about.
Well, the road to Damascus kind of feeling where I actually started.
Since I've matured and more started thinking about things and maybe listening to Tapestry, everybody shut your eyes. Everybody shut your eyes.
The video artist Bill Viola says the true test of art is whether or not it can speak to your innermost self. The way he puts it is this: people have experiences in art museums today that they used to have in church. This is pretty familiar territory for Jenny Hogan. She is the chaplain at Chelsea College of Art and Design and at Goodenough College in London, England.
I think people are going to art galleries without really realizing that it may be filling a spiritual need. Maybe they wake up on a Sunday morning after having a nice brunch and then think, oh, let's do something meaningful. Let's do something improving. Let's take the children along. Let's learn something. So, you know, maybe 30 years ago, it would have been a natural thing to go to church, to learn, to explore, and to do something as a family. Now people go to art galleries instead. So I think that's maybe why there's more and more people going to art galleries than to churches these days.
Now, I know some of this line of thought for you was sparked by various scenes you've seen at the Tate Gallery in London, where people just walk in with uncertain expectations and walk out gobsmacked. Can you tell me what goes on at the Tate that's been so inspiring to you?
Yeah.
And to the sort of spiritual but not religious crowd?
Well, the Tate Modern, which is 10 years old this year, was turned from a power station. That's what it was.
Yes,
a power
yeah.
station. And it was transformed from a derelict building into this this art gallery, this huge kind of temple to contemporary art. There's a turbine hall. You walk in and it's this huge space, enormous space, and it's really awe-inspiring. So I think people go in there with great expectations and they think that something, or they presume that something will change within them, in the way that I think traditionally cathedrals had that effect on people.
And what's at work there? Or would we be talking about one glorious painting set in an appropriate setting, or would you be thinking more of like a curated space, a grand exhibit full of, you know, where architecture and color are a part of this too? I'm thinking staircases built, you know, just for this installation. What kind of thing is weaving a spell on people?
Well, I think really the way that the Tate Modern is set up is that you go in through the Turbine Hall and you have this spectacular, great experience. You know, it's a very simple space once you get away from the Turbine Hall. But I think it's saying something more about what the concept of going to an art gallery is all about. It's worth noting that 5 million people do go to the Tate Gallery every year, and it's free. So just like a church service is free, so is it free to go to the Tate Gallery.
Now, churches have always been home to great art. Mm-hmm. You know, you think of the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo's stained glass windows, the popes being some of the great benefactors of some of the beautiful marble sculptures all through Rome, all through Italy. At what point did that sort of fall down?
Well, I don't think it ever did, to be honest. I think that the church is still a place where art is, in some respects, at its apogee. I think that the churches are a natural home for art. You know, and the St Paul's Cathedral, which is just over the Millennium Bridge, over the Thames, just opposite the Tate Modern, they are doing really marvellous works where they're curating or commissioning new works by artists. There's one by an amazing by a British sculptor, Anthony Gormley, and he put together this amazing sculpture that turns slightly just on under Christopher Wren's asymmetrical surface. It's an abstract piece of art. It's not saying this is religious, this is what it means to be a Christian. It's saying come into this place which has been prayed in for years and years and years. It's a sacred space. Come and look at this and be changed. Look and think about what it means to be human. You know, that I think this is the main problem why people perhaps are going to art galleries on a Sunday morning and not churches, is that people believe that you have to be some signed up person with this absolutely rock solid faith in order to be part of the experience of going into a church or a cathedral. And I think that religion has got such a bad reputation in the world today. Religion needs serious PR, frankly. And people think that that religion or faith, or certainly the Church of England in which I work, is some old fuddy-duddy institution that's got nothing to do with what it means to be human today, which has got no interest in contemporary art, or not even any interest in art, full stop, because I think young people today just have such a low view of religion, which, you know, frankly, as a priest in my early 30s, breaks my heart.
Well, you have a particular vantage point on some of this as a priest and as a chaplain at two colleges of art. What do you see around you in the kids, in the students? Do you see a yearning for some kind of spirituality to be made tangible in their work? Are they completely oblivious to the whole idea? What do you see when you're at school?
I see students trying to understand what it means to be human, or how they see themselves. They're using lots of postmodern contemporary theory, which is all well and good, but there's no space for certainly organized religion, not that much space for spirituality, or, you know, the transcendent. So I think basically they've ditched a lot of religious or spiritual understanding and placed the focus on themselves. And I think that's all well and good, but where do you take that? Where does it go? You know, once you've delved into what you are, what's the next space? And I think perhaps that's one of the issues that I would have with art per se, that going to an art gallery is great. It's transforming. You can understand yourself through art. We can celebrate what it means to be human, or how glorious creation is. But then it stops there if you think that there's nothing beyond that. As a priest, as a Christian, I would say I sometimes want to see art because it makes me rejoice in being myself and being a human being, and I rejoice in the light of God who's created the world. So I think that's the problem. So that's what I see in the art colleges. And I do a weekly tea party in Camberwell College of Art every Monday afternoon. I wear my clerical, so I'm in my black shirt, my white collar, and I put on a quaint kind of English tea party. And I'd say 99% of the students, they think I'm a performance artist.
Oh, no. They don't know what you are?
They think it's so utterly absurd that a priest is in their canteen, in their art gallery, in their college, that they think I'm a performance artist. And interestingly, I did a piece of work just last week in Lille in France with a great company called Ducky that do lots of really experimental performance. And the theme was all about London and what it means in London, the art scene in London, in France, because Saatchi was opening something there. And I did a vicar's tea party, exactly the same thing that I do in the college.
Yes.
And again, everyone thought I was a performance artist, just like the rest, but no, indeed, I am a real-life vicar, and that was a joke, really.
Well, Todd, you know, you mentioned your broken heart a few minutes ago. I'm beginning to understand this a little more deeply. How do you reclaim that ground? Do you say, ha-ha, party's over, guess what, I'm a priest? I mean, what happens next?
Trying not to be too defensive or try too hard, is to explore with them, just by having them next to me and having a cup of tea, is to try and help them understand, just through talking to me, that I actually am really on the pulse about contemporary art. I go to art galleries all the time. I'm not homophobic. I'm not a fuddy-duddy. I'm actually a woman of the world. And that's a real challenge to them. And again, I think that faith should be a place where we're challenged, not just where we're stroked.
I'm intrigued by your position at the art colleges. How does it happen that art schools have a chaplain installed? Is this unusual?
That's not so unusual. The University of Arts London, where I work, there's a chaplain at the London College of Fashion. There's a chaplain at the Central School. Central St Martin's. Again, one of the great art colleges in Britain that, you know, produces magnificent artists. There's a chaplain at Goldsmiths College, where Damien Hirst himself went to. It's a wonderful thing to have priests and chaplains helping students to explore. A lot of what I do is pastoral work, so I provide a pastoral ear and a non-judgmental voice, really, to all students. And students, whether they're scientists or artists, often are going through difficulties, and that's what we're there for. I try to describe myself as a shepherd, trying to look out and help lost sheep.
And is the kettle still on? The tea party still happen?
Oh, it certainly does. It's every week I'm there with my tablecloth and my china teapot, trying to challenge these students that think religion really is dead, and to try and encourage them to think differently.
I'm going to quote something you wrote in the Guardian newspaper recently. You said the aim of art is to reveal, inspire, and question. It is a tragedy that many do not know or cannot accept that belief shares these aims. I'm wondering what it's like for the priest in you, for the reverend in you, to see something like the Tate Modern being a center of awe and a center of transformation in many people's lives, and perhaps the United Church up the street being, what, half empty these days?
I think what really needs to be done is for the church to engage in a more nuanced way, like I said about PR, but nuanced communication, which means, you know, working with the media and with the arts world as well, and to try and bring the art artists into communication with people of faith. And I do think that St Paul's Cathedral have got the right idea when they're commissioning art. There's Bill Viola, who's an American artist.
Oh, yes, the video artist.
Yeah, that's right. So he's been commissioned to put some some screens up in St. Paul's Cathedral. And, you know, I think that's a wonderful, it's a brave move, but it's a wonderful move that St. Paul's Cathedral is a place that's commissioning contemporary art. I think that's the way, and let's bring people into the church that way. If art is more attractive to them, well, let's bring it in and let people come into our cathedrals, which are exceptional places of awe and wonder. And, you know, I also think that's different from an art gallery. When you go into a cathedral, something really changes. It's not just a large space with a high ceiling like the Turbine Hall. It's a place of extravagance. It's a place of that demands quiet, that demands hush and rest. Where else in the world do you get that these days? You don't get it in an art gallery much these days. There's a tiny space in the Tate Modern where there's a Rothko painting. And really interestingly, they've set that up as a kind of quasi chapel because it demands to be pondered and reflected upon. And that's really interesting. You know, I'd love to have those in my chapel at Good Enough College because I want people to sit and reflect. You know, church is a place where mystery is welcomed, where the sacred is at home. You know, Rowan Williams, always a great thinker, described the sacred as gratuitous energy in the world's life. And I just think that's what the human spirit longs for. And we've got that in spades in cathedrals and churches. Let's bring them in. Let's bring them in and encourage people to go beyond themselves and to think about transcendence, to move beyond what does it mean to be me, but what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to understand God being greater than ourselves, the creator of the world, for instance?
If the art gallery has perhaps become the place you go to experience awe and transcendence and transformation, what does the church become?
Well, I think we have to remember that there are priests and clergy all over the world, certainly in this country, that are burying people, marrying people, baptizing people, visiting the sick, having tea with people who have no one else to speak to, are feeding the homeless, that are praying in their cold churches morning and evening. There are places where amazing work is being done and where countless acts of generosity are being acted out every day. It's not glamorous. It's not exciting a lot of the time. But that's what's happening in lots of churches. People, clergy are trying to communicate with people. It's a really hard battle. You know, look at the price of contemporary art. Wouldn't it be fantastic to have Damien Hirst's diamond sculpture, you know, for his piece for the love of God. Mm. For the Love of God is a piece, I don't know whether you know it, but it's a diamond encrusted skull. And the most expensive piece of art in the whole in ever recorded. Wouldn't that be amazing to have that work of art in a poor inner city church in, I don't know, Peckham or Birmingham, somewhere really deprived? Wouldn't it be great if people could experience awe and wonder there? Or, you know, or Tracy Emin's bed. I mean, how much does that cost these days? That's a great piece of art to have in the church because it's all about the modern condition, emancipated women. The church should be a place where those things are explored.
Jenny Hogan, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
The Reverend Jenny Hogan is chaplain at Chelsea School of Art and Design and at Good Enough College in London, England. Toronto singer-songwriter Rosemary Phelan reaches for a kind of art for her solace and inspiration. She turns to music. Phelan was working as a community nurse when she discovered how powerful music can be in end-of-life care. Last spring, she said goodbye to her profession as a community nurse to focus on writing and performing. But when she was putting the finishing touches on her latest CD, Rosemary Phelan was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. CBC Radio's Marina Ray visited Rosemary at her home. Marina brings us the story and the music.
Darling, come close. What are you afraid of? Whisper your secret into my ear. You say nobody.
Well, before I recorded this CD, I was working as a community nurse in Toronto, which basically means I drive around and visit people in their homes. As far as the types of patients I would see in the community, it truly ranged from everything from a high-profile surgeon in a post-road mansion to people who didn't even have a place, and we would have to meet in a building lobby to do their wound care. But what I learned very early on is that illness is a tremendous equalizer, and those people were all the same. They wanted one thing, which was to be well.
You stood your ground through some dark, stormy hours, and sure, you're a little bit bent from the rain. Just shake off the dreams that don't fit anymore, 'cause behind the pale flower I sense a bright flame.
The first time I sang to a patient was an elderly Italian gentleman, and he was lying in his bed very close to death, and he was fingering his rosary, and his family were all wailing and crying and just pacing the house in terrible anguish. And the man was in such pain, and he just wanted some peace, and he was trying to concentrate on his rosary. So I had sung at a few weddings, and I'd been requested to sing the Ave Maria a few times, so I knew the Ave Maria, so I thought, well, that would work for him probably. So I just sat, and I very quietly started to sing the Ave Maria, and he just put his rosary down and became so peaceful. And then one by one, the family heard what was happening, and the whole house just fell quiet. And he was able to have that peace. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, I'm putting this in my nursing bag along with my other equipment. And so then I sort of tried to perceive the different times when I was in similar situations, whether it would be appropriate or helpful. And then I found out that there was an actual course of study for music for end-of-life care.
Red wing, oh red wing, in the blue sky, won't you come down and tell what you see from on high?
I think the biggest thing that did for me was it stripped away whatever vestige may have been left of the attitude that music needed to be about self-expression, and completely transformed my thinking to be that music needs to be about selflessness.
Oh, you never do know if tomorrow will come. A red wing, oh, red wing, in the blue sky.
The music is a bigger thing. I don't want to bring that down. I want to find a way to always feel what I felt with that first gentleman, which was that it was about the music. It was not about me. It was not even really about him. It was about something bigger that only music can express. And even when I perform, I'm a very reluctant performer. Before I get on stage, I just remind myself that if I feel any different right now than I would if I was going to go dress a wound on someone's leg, then there's something wrong. Because I need to bring the same attitude of love and caring when I perform that I do if I'm groveling on a roach-infested floor trying to, you know, wash someone's feet and dress their wounds. And that's how I know I'm in the right place.
Alone, red wing, oh red wing, in the blue sky. Won't you come down and tell what you see from on high?
The role of music in my life since becoming ill has changed quite a bit. I was diagnosed having been the nurse who went out in the community and would occasionally use music with patients as an effort to help with their pain control or their fear around dying or their unresolved issues that couldn't be spoken about, but, you know, music would often bring some peace. I'm understanding from their perspective now how the music was helpful. I keep wanting to go back almost to early childhood and remember what it was like to feel the music when I didn't know anything about it, when I just responded to life through singing or through sitting at the piano. There's a certain simplicity and a certain inner magic that happens when you approach the music that way. The music I'm reaching for mostly right now is improvisational, which is how I started as a child. My first instrument was an accompaniment instrument, which was my mother's vacuum cleaner, and because she liked to vacuum every day. And I would just sing these long musical soliloquies about life and the things that I saw around me that sounded probably very similar to plain song or to chant to the accompaniment of some drone. And now I use a Shruti box to get that same drone as my mother's vacuum cleaner used to have. But it's improvisational. And in the work around music for end-of-life care, most of the music is also improvisational. And, you know, through this strange twist of my present circumstances, I now understand why that is and how powerfully effective that is. I'm trying to recapture a sort of very innocent relationship with music that has no formula and that comes from, you know, deep inside. Going back to what I was saying about trying to engage the music on a more basic or innocent level, like the way we do when we're children, that really is what I find healing. And when we are playing for people who are in pain or dying and need that solace, it's because these people, when they're so ill and their world has become so small, it's just, you know, their breath and their body. And now I understand you cease to do and you just be. And the simple music improvised by someone who has a loving intent, it supports that feeling of just being. And when you're very ill, you need that time to just breathe and to just be and to almost recollect yourself. And that's the effect that that music has. People say, well, music, it's a combination of melody, harmony, you know, music and words, whatever. But I would say that music is a combination of those things and intent. Because so much of what we can't define about music, so much of what's essential about it, has to do with the intent of the person creating it. So when I would play or sing for someone who was very ill or in pain, I know now firsthand that the first thing you feel is the person's intent before you even hear the music.
But home, there's an echo inside. Home. It sings in the blood, it rings in the bone, every soul has a home.
It's pretty clear where artist Robert Bateman finds his muse. His vivid depictions of the natural world are iconic, and they've brought him international fame. What's less well known about the artist is the way he thinks about the inner life. Robert Bateman, welcome to Tapestry.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
I know you don't like to be asked why you are so inspired by the natural world. You once said it's like asking Degas why he hung around backstage at the ballet.
Yeah.
But I'm so interested in nature as inspiration. What part of you is fed when you are out in nature, when you're in the natural world?
It's all of me. But I think it's all of us. Homo sapiens and I guess all sentient beings, we live in an environment. We've spent hundreds of thousands of years living surrounded by a completely natural world, natural things, all tuned into them. We had all kinds of skills for thousands and thousands of years that we've lost. And it's just part of every person's being. Most normal human beings love to do art in nature when they're little, but they grow up and do more mature things around the age of 12, and I just have not yet reached that grown-up stage.
I heard the saying once that there are two kinds of great books. So you have the Bible, the Quran, the Upanishads, and you have nature, the other, mm-hmm. what some have called the Book of God, the other book that might reveal something that's worth knowing about life. Can you tell me about a moment you've had, something you've seen, something you've painted, that had that feeling to it that made you feel you were in the midst of some kind of holy book, sacred place?
Wow, I've never had that question before, and there's so many. There's thousands and thousands and thousands, but one that I wrote a little book when I turned 70 in the year 2000, called Thinking Like a Mountain, and the first chapter is a day in May, and I think everybody in the world should have a place where they can go in times of trial and tribulation, that sort of thing. And I sometimes when I start giving a talk, I say, everybody shut your eyes. Now think of a place that is meaningful deep in your heart. And I'll give them a moment or two, and then I'll say, I bet you has something to do with nature.
You're right. I just did it. Right,
yeah,
here.
But my place is right here in Toronto in the old Beltline Ravine, which is it's now a wonderful walking trail. Thanks partly to my mother that helped to save it from being divided up into private property backyards. And it was a railroad tracks that ran behind our house. I lived on Chaplin Crescent. And it was all tangles of in that ravine of grapevines and, all the different kinds of trees that were growing there, Manitoba maples and everything. And I this one particular day, I just sat still. And it was a big rush of warbler migration that comes across Lake Ontario. Enters the dawn, and the Beltline Ravine is a tributary to the dawn. And I think I said at the time that the branches were just dripping with warblers and kinglets and yellow-bellied sapsuckers and all kinds of things. And that day in May just comes back. The hummingbirds were back and the blossoms were out. And I think you could say that was one of those moments.
There's the old story about people who say, well, I don't go to church on Sunday, but I go for a walk, and it's like I'm in a cathedral. I mean, have you had that feeling that it's almost a way of tapping into something bigger?
Yes, absolutely, and especially more since I've matured and more started thinking about things and maybe listening to Tapestry and other people's ideas on things and spirituality and religion. And where we live, luckily, we live on Salt Spring Island, and we live near nature. And even if it isn't our property, I sort of make these secret little trails. I would plan kind of sacred places. I would make the trail go from special places where there may be a gigantic maple. We got these big maples out west that are called big leaf maple, and they form like a cathedral dome. And so I'm in this space underneath the cathedral, and then it's sword ferns and all that underneath. And I deliberately stop and breathe, and I might even say a little prayer or two and think kind of nice thoughts. And there was another place I remember we stopped near an old First Nations gathering place, and maybe there's spiritual stuff in the air or the ground or something there, I don't know. But the tall tree trunks, the Douglas firs and the balsam firs and so on, make me think of inside Chartres Cathedral. And so I stopped there too. So I maybe have three places where I go, and I would do it every day after lunch, usually, and my wife Birgit would go with me.
So it almost sounds like a little pilgrimage outside.
It is every day.
From a tree to another
exactly.
tree to a spot. There, you're reminding me of this beautiful quote by the author of The Little Prince, Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, and he says, "A pile of rocks ceases to be a rock when somebody contemplates it with the idea of a cathedral in mind." Do you ever feel a kind of contemplation in that sense when you are painting a red fox or a tiger or a great blue heron? Are you beholding something that has that kind of majesty in it?
I think so. I hope I do, but it's probably unconscious or subconscious. Mm-hmm. One thing I do kind of pride myself in, I try to get inside the skin. I've always been interested in films and theater and that sort of thing, and I kind of think of the Stanislavski method, the method acting, where I feel I'm in a red-tailed hawk, and red-tailed hawks have their expression's kind of like Omar Sharif. They've got kind of a noble but lustrous big dark eyes and that sort of thing, whereas the bald eagles are sort of reptilian, and so I sometimes almost make my face go a little bit the way the thing's going. I'm not totally kooky about it, and usually I don't do that, but I try to get inside the skin a bit. So you have to think the red-tailed hawk. Mm. You have to think the form of that leaf or that clump of grass. So if you think it, it will come. It's a philosophical thing. It has nothing to do with your wrist or your fingers or anything like that.
Yeah.
It comes from somewhere.
So this trying to get inside the skin and trying to get inside the Stanislavski method, as you put it,
right.
Would you feel that as well in painting an inanimate, what we think of as an inanimate thing when you're painting a scene or clouds? Or I've seen parts of landscape of yours that feel so powerful without a living being.
I do this if you think it. I do want to think that I've entered it, that I've gone... like opening that closet door, was it with C.S.
Lewis? C.S. Lewis, yeah.
And then...
Narnia.
Narnia.
I think
a little bit like that you enter through the picture plane, which would be the glass, so the picture was framed in glass, and then you go down this little bank and you go across the stream, and then the stream's too deep here, so you have to go up a little bit, and then you can step on stepping stones and go across, and then up another little bank, and you can move. I want you to be able to move through my polar bear's pelt, or whatever it is, and understand all the things that are underneath it. That's not so much spiritual as maybe technical and anatomical.
Mm.
I have, in fact, painted a large glacial erratic boulder that I got kind of druid. And I was going through sort of psychological turmoil then to do with marriage and things and finally getting together with my wife, Birgit. And I used to go and touch it. I was a school teacher at the time, and I go for a long hike, and maybe there's something in the rock, maybe there isn't, but it had come a long way, brought down there by the glacier, sitting there. And
you've said you do. I was intrigued a moment ago when you said you'd be by a glorious big tree and almost the cathedral of leaves,
right.
Branches overhead, and that you might say a prayer, you might not. And you've said something intriguing to me, that you do believe in prayer, you do believe in heaven, but I love this kind of let the buyer beware that you throw in there. There's this little caveat, and I'm going to quote you here. You said, well, believing is useful in getting through this life.
Exactly.
But so do you believe because you believe, or do you believe because it just gets you through the day and gets you through the night?
It's kind of a trick of the trade of being alive, I think. And there are all kinds of questions. I agree with... Dawkins and Hitchens and 90% of all their easy, like shooting fish in a barrel, all the stupid things that the Bible tells you to do, and a lot of these other religious books tell you to do. I agree with a lot of that, but that's not the point. That's throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
So what's the point? What's at the heart of it?
The point is having a spiritual life and believing in something is a good idea, and maybe you have to suspend disbelief if you wish to, it's a choice that you make if you wish to have the advantages of belief, I guess, put it that way.
What do you think would happen if you, Robert Bateman, sat down and painted an industrial park or a motorway or a concrete slab of a building. Suspend disbelief for a minute. what do you think you'd come up with?
One can argue that I love Toronto. I live in this beautiful bucolic Salt Spring Island now, but I love coming back to Toronto.
Yeah, you have mentioned that, and it's really annoying me. Yeah, you live on Salt Spring Island.
No, I grew up in Toronto. Old Toronto is just wonderful, and the back alleys have these trees that can survive in any kind of pollution called the Chinese Tree of Heaven.
Huh.
See, I believe in knowing the names of things, too.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's full of color and character and richness. Now, a shopping mall is different from an old 19th or the brickworks in the Don Valley. That's a fantastic subject for painting or photography. So I don't feel downhearted or like I'm visiting hell or anything when I when I do that. And maybe I do a little more when I'm in a shopping mall. But
because most people from Salt Spring Island do feel like they're visiting hell when they come to Toronto. So this is very refreshing.
I'm not one of them. I love it.
But the mall has come up a couple of times, and it's interesting what you say about a place like a character-filled back alley in the city,
yes.
or the beautiful old brickworks display by the Don River and the Don Valley. What's the distinction between that and the mall? Why is the mall so offensive?
I call that the instant pudding world. Almost one aspect of my religion is that we have been busily destroying our natural heritage and human heritage with a vengeance since the 1950s. So I would say if you love to say goodbye, then you're living in the best time in the history of the planet, because this is say goodbye time, and it's intensified. But it's not being replaced with nothing. It's been replaced with instant pudding, which I describe, and you can make it sheriffs or Jell-O or whatever. It's sweet, smooth, slick, extremely convenient. You have nothing whatever to do with the ingredients. Joe Blow Associates puts those ingredients in. For marketing purposes, if you even read the labels, you don't know what they're going to do to your system. And I'm using this as a metaphor for suburbs, plazas, and throughways, of course, which is what I call instant pudding. So it's all manufactured by somebody somewhere else who doesn't know you. And I think it's a deadly thing that's spreading over the planet. And so things like shopping malls are all... they're spiffy and brand new and convenient and automated and heartless and not human at all.
What do you think that does to the human being, to the human spirit, to, for want of a better word, to the soul? What happens to the soul in that environment?
Well, I think it's soul destroying. And I hate to say this, but I think we can see it when we look at some of the results. Did you ever do television channel flipping? We don't get that many at home, but in a hotel.
Oh, sure. Well,
people actually watch these things? I think it also maybe accounts for that we've got a new species of people that don't go outdoors anymore. They spend, the average 14-year-old, I just read this 2 weeks ago, it's recent research, spends 7.5 hours every day looking at an electronic screen. I'd settle. They spend 4 hours on the screens and spend 3 hours out of doors every day.
You're not asking for the whole, throw them all out.
I'll
get
compromise.
Outside.
Yeah.
We're in this episode. We are exploring the relationship between art and spirituality. Where do you see that in the art you create?
Gee, that's hard to say because I just do it for myself because I can't stop. I should have brought my sketchbook to show you, but I always have my sketchbook with me. And I used to be in a lot of boards of naturalist clubs and things like that. And I did reams. I've got file folders of drawings that I would do during meetings.
Meetings, you just start to sketch.
Yes, in one half of my brain, I can pay close attention. I talk on the telephone, have interviews, and be busily painting away on my paintings. When we had our kids growing up, I'm oblivious to a baby crying. To the kid can be going through a tantrum and I'll hold them on my left knee and jiggle my knee up and down and keep on painting. I would be just drawing away because I have to draw all the time and painting away. And I do it for myself. I don't do it for anybody's spiritual awakening. I've been told that my books have been used in palliative care centers and there are a whole bunch of stories like that. But as soon as I start talking that way, I sound like I'm really getting self-congratulatory and all that kind of thing. And I don't pay attention to it or record it or anything. But I keep hearing that type of thing all the time. And actually, I'm I'm pleased, but I'm sort of puzzled because nature's real nature's all around. I mean, I'm just a facsimile, and there's wonderful photographs all around, wonderful nature shows on TV. But at any rate, it seems to work, and we definitely know that real nature works too.
You've quoted Oscar Wilde in some of your public speaking. Why is America so violent? I will tell you why America is so violent. Because the wallpaper is so ugly. And the lesson there for you, and you hope for your listeners, is that Oscar Wilde cared about aesthetics, and so should everyone. Why does beauty matter in the context of the human spirit?
I think it is so downplayed in our society and this modern instant pudding world, which is all marketing and commercialism. They do use beauty and nature all the time, you notice, in car ads and everything. So it's used. But in our surroundings, we're waking up a little bit, but we've designed these really ugly human places to live. And all through history, going right back to, I don't like to use the word primitive, but to tribal peoples. In fact, pre-tribal, such as the Bambuti of the Inturi forest, the pygmies, their dwellings are harmonized with nature. And you think of the cliff-dwelling people, the Pueblo Indians, and you think of the Haida and their beautiful dwellings, and a wigwam or an igloo, their perfection. We know the mayor of New York was...
Bloomberg or Giuliani.
Giuliani.
Yes, yeah.
He cleaned up the broken windows and the garbage, and the crime went down.
And what follows from that?
Exactly. Yeah. There is a moral force to aesthetics, and it's time we kind of recognized it.
I read the convocation speech you delivered at Royal Roads University, and this was a beautiful piece of work, I think. A lot of wisdom, and you talk about being an octogenarian in that speech. A life lived, that kind of wisdom. Some of your advice to graduates was to fall in love with being here, with life on Earth, and to stop worrying. This one is so much easier said than done, the stop worrying. Are you able to take your own advice on this one?
I think I am. I've worked on myself. I used to be kind of a worry wart, and I was a shy kid growing up, and I think I've finally shaken that a few decades ago. But I've had a cancer scare, which we don't have time to go into, and I worked on myself then. I go into a Zen-like state, and I think of the importance of now. We get the Shambhala Sun, the Buddhist magazine, and read about the three-breath meditation and that sort of thing, and try to be focused on the now. And when I'm signing books for people, which I'm on a book tour right now for my new book, New Works, it's called, Bateman New Works. The person standing in front of me is the only one in the world for me at that moment, 100%. And I'm interested in them, and I truly am. I'm not faking it. And then I have to say this, it sounds cruel, 3 seconds later, they're actually toast. I shouldn't say that. And the one in front of me now is the only one in the world for me. This is terrible. But anyway, but that's why, that's one way, that's one device. Another device is to pretend you're in a movie. But I like what I recently read from Mark Twain is some of the worst things in my life never happened. And so why waste time worrying? I remember saying this actually when I was in my 20s. Worrying does not make any sense. Either do something, as in the Alcoholic's Prayer, and if you can't do anything, don't do anything, and then put it out of your mind. So do whatever you can do. I don't mean just be a toy of, you know, floating along the stream.
Yeah.
You should be able to steer your canoe a little bit. But then put it out of your mind, because the worrying part doesn't work. And I said in that speech, and procrastinate. And I found if I say, okay, this is maybe worth worrying about, but I haven't time. I'm not going to worry about it right now because there's other things going on.
So procrastinate about your worrying.
Procrastinate about the worrying, yeah. Yeah, put it off. So I'm going in for this medical procedure. Well, there's no use worrying about it now. It's 2 weeks away. I'll worry about it when I'm on the threshold of the hospital. Well, then when you're on the threshold of the hospital, it's like you've entered a rapids and you're in the canoe and you're too busy steering your way through the hospital. And I'm trying to, you know, I'm smiling at the nurses and I'm paying attention to the color of the walls and all that. I'm still zen-like. Yeah. And I end up not worrying.
I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to meet you and to just have you here in the studio having this conversation. Thank you so much.
Well, the pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much.
Robert Bateman is a renowned wildlife artist. He lives on Salt Spring Island. His latest book of art is called Bateman New Works, and it's published by Greystone Books. Tapestry is produced by Nicola Lukšić and Aaron Pettit. Sound design for this episode is by Tom Howell. Studio production is by Dave Field. Liz Nagy manages our website. I'm Mary Hines. See you next week.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.